Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Conversations and commentary featuring scholars and visitors at the center. This is Wayne Pond. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life.
Well, the money is certainly reaching many people. I'm just arguing that the people it's reaching are people who already have privilege, who already have opportunities, and not the people who are in greatest need.
Charity begins at home, philanthropy in the United States, this week on Soundings. We begin with a conversation featuring Teresa Odendahl. Terry Odendahl is the author of a new book about America's philanthropic elite. Following that discussion, you'll hear commentary on Terry Odendahl's new book from Joel Fleischman. Joel Fleischman is a professor of law and public policy at Duke University. Terry Odendahl is the author of Charity Begins at Home, Generosity and Self-Interest Among the Philanthropic Elite, published earlier this year by Basic Books. Terry Odendahl, welcome to Soundings. Your book is Charity Begins at Home. What is the culture of philanthropy?
The culture of philanthropy is a label that I've given to the lifestyle of a group of people who have millions of dollars and give much of their money away to charity. Now, the majority of these people come from what is generally known as old money.
What, a couple of hundred years old?
Generally, the money was made at the turn of the century.
Uh-huh.
And so it's been in their family for several generations, and they've learned in their family and their communities and their prep schools and their universities that philanthropy is a responsibility, that they must give away some of their money in order to be good citizens.
Is this charity or is it guilt? How much do you psychologize the corporate, the culture of philanthropy?
Well, I try to investigate the various motives for giving, mm-hmm. and guilt is among one of the incentives to give.
Is it principal?
No, I wouldn't say it's the principal incentive, but certainly for a group of fourth, fifth generation young people, uh-huh. who feel somewhat embarrassed about the way, who were brought up in the 60s,
right.
and feel somewhat embarrassed about the way in which the money was made, guilt is a prime motivator. And then for even some self-made millionaires who I haven't mentioned yet, there are a number of people in the culture of philanthropy besides these old moneyed people, although mm-hmm. the majority come from old money. Anyway, some self-made millionaires, for example, if they've made their money in armaments, they may give heavily to peace issues. They wouldn't have told me that guilt was a reason they gave, but if you look at the data, you can draw those conclusions.
How much money are we talking about when you use this term, the culture of philanthropy? Hundreds of millions? Billions? What?
We're talking about billions of dollars. The best estimates are that the whole of the nonprofit sector is about a $300 billion industry. Mm. And by my estimate, about half of the giving into this sector comes from wealthy people, either directly from them, from foundations that they control, or from corporations in which they're heavily invested. So I this is a guesstimate, but about $150 billion, something in that magnitude.
Terry Odendahl, describe for me the giving patterns of the culture of philanthropy. Where does this money go?
Well, what I found in interviewing 140 multimillionaires and an additional 200 advisors to the wealthy.
The Robin Leach of scholarship.
That's right. is that the money primarily goes to the institutions, and it's the kinds of institutions that wealthy people themselves participate in. So, for example, they go to Ivy League colleges and universities, mm-hmm. or other private institutions of higher learning. They go to preparatory schools. They go to institutions of what is generally called high culture, that is the ballet, the symphony, museums, art, presentations, these types of activities. So my basic argument in the book is that instead of charity being a device whereby the needy are assisted, at least for wealthy individuals, mm-hmm. charity is a device whereby they assist themselves as a group or a class.
Aren't you, I mean no disrespect personally, but aren't you making a very risky assumption here that you say charity begins at home, but this is America. It's a free country. It's their money. Why should they give it away to the poor? Why can't they perpetuate the institutions that nurtured them and that they love?
I think that people, anyone, no matter what their income or wealth, can give their money to anything they want, except that with regard to charity, you get a large tax deduction for giving. That's both on income tax and estate tax. Mm-hmm. And so the reason that I think this whole area merits greater investigation is because of these large charitable incentives, and also because wealthy people exercise a good deal of power in the nonprofit sector that's largely invisible, that's mm-hmm. hidden behind a kind of cloak of privacy because of two things. One, our assumption that giving, charitable giving in particular, is doing good. And secondly, in the last two decades through two Republican administrations, there have been severe cutbacks in the provision of basic human services by the government. Mm-hmm. The rhetoric of these administrations has been that the private sector is going to take over.
Yeah, you're talking about President Reagan and the private sector, and then President Bush and the thousand points of light.
Exactly.
And I take it, Terry Odendahl, your argument is that this has just not happened.
It hasn't happened, and what I discovered in talking to these millionaires is that they don't view it as their responsibility to provide these types of services. The kinds of charity that they do give and that they're going to continue to give on any large scale is the type of charity that I've described earlier. First of all, it seems to me that although this is America, one of the sort of prices of the freedom that we have is taxation. And it was decided quite a while ago that the charitable incentive would be introduced. And yet there's no way to make sure that the kinds of giving that we do is democratic in a sense.
Well, and let me stop you for a moment. Then why don't we simply lobby to change the tax laws? Would that by itself remedy this large problem that you've been describing?
Well, that's one of the points that I make in my final chapter, that we could consider lobbying to change the tax law. It also seems to me that at the local level, certainly, but at the national level as well, we could have more representative boards that made decisions about where the money goes.
Oh, I can hear the wealthy. This would be like going to the lawyers and the doctors and trying to invade their Kabbalistic professional sense of how the world should operate. They're gonna scream like bloody murder at this, aren't they?
Well, there are some very good models, such as the community foundations. There are nearly 400 community foundations around the country, and a person of any means can contribute into this foundation. They have some amount of discretion during their lifetime over where the funds go. Mm-hmm. But then, for example, if they've established an endowment, after their death, this endowment would be administered by a representative group of people. I would argue that the people most affected should also be a part of the decision-making process, so that it's kind of a community in terms of the nonprofit sector, the so-called grantees, that is the supplicants, the people who are holding out their hands for money, as well as the people who are giving the money, could all be a part of the decision-making.
Aren't you going to replicate essentially the mess of democracy as it exists in our Congress and our legislation?
Well, who says that's a mess? I mean, why should that be a mess?
Fair enough. Tell me why.
Well, it seems to me that we are a democratic country, and that if people are getting a large tax break for this money, it is not truly private money, mm-hmm. that it's actually public money, that therefore there should be some accountability in how the decisions are made about where the gifts go, what kind of access is available to grant seekers when they're looking for funds, and how the decisions are made in general.
All right. Now, Terry Odendahl, tell me about some of these multimillionaires that you interviewed when you wrote this book, Charity Begins at Home. I've had this vision in my mind of these interviews. Hello, I'm Teresa Odendahl. I'm writing a book about charity. You got a lot of money. You're a bad guy. What was the conversation like?
No, it was
like?
Exactly the opposite, in fact, I would say. Although you might be interested that it took me nearly a year to obtain my first official interview for the study.
And you did 140?
I did 140. There were other interviewers as well, but I was the project manager. I had to go to each part of the country and establish some kind of rapport with at least one millionaire or with an advisor to a millionaire. And in this way, they would then introduce me to others in their circle, in their social circle or their networks. Another thing that I had to do was to promise them confidentiality. In other words, most of these people would not have given me the information in detail that they did if I hadn't given them that promise.
Do you think that they were straight with you for the most part?
Absolutely. I felt confident that they told me at least what they thought was the truth. Of course, there are many truths, but I think they were telling me what they thought was the truth. Finally, because we think of philanthropy as doing good, they thought that they were talking to me about the good things that they do. And indeed, at the beginning of this study, I would say that I had the same assumptions as everyone else, that charity is a good thing, and I'm asking to talk to these people about something that's central in their lives and for which they should be applauded. Mm-hmm. It was only after I had conducted a large number of interviews and begun analyzing the data that a pattern emerged for me, that I began to see the kinds of things that they were giving to, and I began to question whether or not the system of elite philanthropy, and here I want to stress I'm only talking about the philanthropy of the very wealthy, not the philanthropy of the middle class or the poor, whether or not indeed was doing what the American public and the legislators who had framed the charitable deduction had intended.
Do you think of this as a prodigal society, and the people that you've been investigating, are they essentially prodigal with their wealth?
No, quite the opposite. In terms of my analysis, I see charity as a means by which wealthy people are able to preserve their fortunes rather than to give their fortunes away. This is another area that hasn't been investigated very closely, although, of course, if you're an estate or tax attorney, you know this quite well. That is that people use charitable lead and charitable remainder trusts where, quite briefly, if you give some of your interest income away for a period of years, then the bulk of your fortune can be inherited by, you're giving it away to a nonprofit organization, then the bulk of your fortune can be inherited tax-free by your heirs. Mm. So charity serves serves multiple purposes.
Terry Odendalt, does the culture of philanthropy have any effect on education in this country? I know that we've got a lot of business types who are saying, we, the business community, we're having to re-educate American youth. Am I making too much of a leap here? How do the philanthropic types think about what they do vis-a-vis education?
Well, I think that there is a relationship between the culture of philanthropy and education, but it's a relationship primarily with what I would call high education. That is the
Harvard, Yale.
That type of education that is provided at these kinds of institutions rather than the type of education that's provided at public institutions. On the other hand, it's important to note that wealthy people are now increasingly giving large donations to public institutions, and they're doing so because of a great need. State legislatures are tending to cut the budgets of institutions of higher education. And my question is, to what extent do the wealthy then have an opportunity to begin controlling public education in a way in which they haven't in the past? This is something we haven't discussed much in the program today, but another concern of mine is the extent of control and power that the wealthy have in comparison with other people.
Well, let's follow that line of reasoning for just a moment. When you say control and power, are you talking about what our just our large sense of the shape of the culture, where we're heading with our education and our artistic expression, and then I suppose even our political, our ideological identity.
Yes.
Fill that in for me.
This is all true. It you could think of it in terms of a spectrum, wherein there are wealthy people who exercise control simply in choosing what organizations are funded and what organizations are not funded. Mm-hmm. In other words, it's increasingly becoming the case that unless there's a wealthy patron, an organization is not going to make it, so to speak. So that's one avenue of control, deciding what organizations make it and what organizations don't. At the other end of the spectrum are those wealthy people who actually want to exercise control within the organizations mm-hmm. that they fund. That is, they want to decide what kind of art is good art, what kind of music is good music, what the local symphony will play and not play, and taking it to an even greater extreme, although this is not generally the case, there can be a way in which the wealthy set a kind of intellectual agenda by deciding what types of chairs they're willing to fund and what kinds of departments, whether or not the sciences are going to be emphasized at universities in comparison to the humanities and so forth.
Terry Odendahl, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Your book is Charity Begins at Home. Why should the rich listen to your criticisms? Why? What is it, you know, realistically that you expect is going to get through in this message that you're delivering?
Well, I hope that wealthy people will read my book with an open mind and think about their giving programs and think about the consequences of their gifts, because most of the people I interviewed, in fact, all of them have good intentions. So it's not the intentions that I'm questioning, but rather the outcome of where their money goes. Many of them, for example, give smaller gifts to what they consider programs for the needy, but their largest gifts go to these institutions that I described earlier. So just to review their own giving programs. Also, I hope that public policymakers and people in the general society will take a look at what charity, elite charity in any event, really does.
Here's a footnote to our conversation, Teresa Odendahl. Your book is Charity Begins at Home. We're recording this conversation at the National Humanities Center. This is a nonprofit institution. At the risk of self-service or extreme criticism, I don't know where you're going to take the answer. How does a place like this, a think tank that nurtures scholarship in the liberal arts, how does this fit into this whole scheme of the culture of philanthropy?
Well, it would seem to me that an institution such as the National Humanities Center is one in which the people in the culture of philanthropy would want to put their money. It's the kind of institution that they would be attracted to.
I'm glad to hear you say this. Why? The obvious
question.
Well,
because it promotes both a kind of intellectual agenda that I spoke of earlier, and it's also involved with what we might call high culture or high education. If your system works the way that we all hope it does, those with greatest merit are the ones who are offered fellowships at this institution. And yet, this is the question I would ask of you. In a time of severe federal cutbacks to basic human service programs, in a time when homelessness is on the increase, is this where the money should be going? If we have to make hard decisions about where the money goes, is the National Humanities Center our first preference?
And how do you answer that?
Well, I think it's a kind of a delicate balance. My own view is that it's quite appropriate for philanthropy to fund centers of higher education such as this one, and that it's appropriate for government to fund basic human services. So what I'm looking for is not the end of philanthropy or the end of choice for wealthy individuals, but rather for the government to begin reassuming the responsibilities that we had expected or have expected, at least since the New Deal, that they would undertake.
You've been listening to a conversation with Teresa Odendahl. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Terry Odendahl is the author of Charity Begins at Home, Generosity and Self-Interest Among the Philanthropic Elite, published earlier this year by Basic Books. Soundings on Philanthropy in the United States continues now with commentary about Terry Odendahl's book. The commentator is Joel Fleischman. Joel Fleischman is a professor of law and public policy at Duke University. He also serves as chairman of the Duke University Capital Campaign for the Arts, Sciences, and Engineering. Here is Joel Fleischman.
Charity Begins at Home, Generosity and Self-Interest Among the Philanthropic Elite is reminiscent of nothing so much as Alice in Wonderland. Despite the aura of its title, it is not a work of objective scholarship, but rather a fairy tale about a wide-eyed naïf encountering the life of the wealthy for the first time. Ms. Odendahl simply cannot fathom what might conceivably prompt the rich to give away such large sums of money to charity. She is too sophisticated to believe that such donors could honestly be motivated by a wish to do some good. Her explanation is that the philanthropic elite deliberately uses its charitable gifts for the purpose of solidifying its class power, whatever that means. Odendahl tells about her first interview, a visit with a very rich woman who lives unostentatiously in an upper-floor apartment in her mansion. We get a detailed description of how Odendahl was decked out, a subdued brown suit with a silk blouse carrying a leather briefcase, the floral arrangement, tropical, the thickly carpeted staircase with carved wooden banisters, the size of the dining room, probably at least twice as big as my middle-class parents' living room, she says, the dining room table, highly polished dark wood with matching chairs, the kind of table at which they had lunch, white wicker, what they ate, cold chicken, salad, and toasted croissants, the view from the balcony on which they had lunch, sailboats glinted in the distance. Have you ever seen sailboats glinting, I wonder, rather than the water on which they sail? Obviously, Odendahl is so dazzled by the wealth of her interviewee and so tickled by her devilish glee over what she intends to make of it that she cannot see the sailboats for the glinting of the gold. All of this, and page after page more of the like, is used to no point except as anecdotal evidence for the existence of some alleged class-purposed system of philanthropy. It is supposedly a system which sustains elite universities such as Yale, art museums, symphonies, operas, and hospitals, not because they serve worthy purposes, but because they are institutions which benefit the upper class. Hence the conclusory title, Charity Begins at Home, proclaiming the polemical nature of the entire work and driving her point home with the subtitle alleging self-interest, just in case you missed the point. Having absolute faith in that assumption, and without adducing even one solid piece of evidence to validate her theory, she creates a dream world of her own, peopled with naughty donors motivated by her projected imaginings, whom she then proceeds to condemn simply because they choose to give away their largesse to causes other than those she thinks most worthy. In being permitted freely to do so, and indeed being encouraged by a tax deduction, the rich, she alleges, in effect subvert democratic institutions and perpetuate inequality in public services. How is it that they do so? By attending not to the needs of the poor, disabled, and disadvantaged, but to the institutions they themselves care most about. As she says, a system of private charity is not in the interests of the disadvantaged. At root, Odendahl is essentially opposed to the system of private charity in which donors make their own free choices. She prefers all welfare choices to be made by the state. She glibly asserts that the support of the rich for such fields as private education, high art, music, opera, and private hospitals benefits the rich to a greater extent than others. That is never proved in any way except as a tautology. The rich give more to those causes because they are more interested in them. What she intends to convey, hence the title, is to use the word interest in two different senses at the same time. Interest in the enlarged sense of what belongs to one, and interest in the sense of matters which draw one's attention and concern. By alleging the former, when all that her facts prove is the latter, is a deliberate falsification of meaning itself. If all contributions were to be tainted by a charge of self-interest, when one gives to those causes to which one is drawn by shared interest, such as music lovers giving to symphonies or classical radio stations, or history, philosophy, and literature lovers giving to the National Humanities Center, or alumni to their colleges, or nature lovers to environmental and conservation organizations, or congregants to their churches, then virtually all of what we know as charity, everything but alms for the poor, would be self-interested, and calling it so would mean absolutely nothing except to demean the intelligence and judgment of the one doing the calling. Finally, as if she might suspect she had failed to prove the motivation she alleges, she then attacks the charitable rich not because of anything they themselves do, but because their philanthropy is, in her words, invoked by its proponents as an argument against redistribution of wealth by the government. Is it just, I wonder, to condemn those who give to what interests them simply because the government or other donors fail to fulfill their responsibility to provide resources for other needs to which those who do give are not drawn? There are precious few morsels to redeem this sad tale. One of them is when she observes that, in general, the charitable wealthy live well below their means. They are conspicuous contributors rather than conspicuous consumers. That's the one jewel of a turn of phrase in this entire 250-page book, and it is used as if what is described is somehow subversive. One cannot help but wonder if Odendahl has ever thought about how the upper classes in other countries, which have virtually no tradition of large individual philanthropic giving, have maintained the much more rigid and exclusionary upper classes in those countries. Such other nationals get along quite well in their allegedly principled concern of maintaining their class status without using, indeed by utterly avoiding, philanthropic giving. If that is so, and the evidence seems unassailable that it is, one cannot help but ask what the U.S. rich need or want that would motivate them to use philanthropy to such an end. One can believe that our society should spend more for the less well-off, as I strongly do. One can believe that our tax structure should be more progressive than it is. One can even make the case for a more equitable tax subsidy for charitable gifts, without for a moment tolerating support for those positions from the kind of specious conspiracy theory, obsessive class warfare dogma, or spurious social science that are the fabric of this lamentable book. Indeed, all who care seriously about those reforms or about social justice itself must weep at the damage a book such as this does to our cause.
Joel Fleischman is Senior Vice President at Duke University. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Joel Fleischman reviewed a new book by Teresa Odendahl entitled Charity Begins at Home, Generosity and Self-Interest Among the Philanthropic Elite. Soundings on Philanthropy in the United States is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Ask for program number 533. That's program number 533. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about favorite poems of English readers worldwide. My guest will be William Harmon of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. William Harmon is the editor of the Concise Columbia Book of Poetry, a collection of the 100 most frequently anthologized poems in the English language. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Charity Begins at Home, Philanthropy in the United States, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Teresa Odendahl discusses her book, Charity Begins at Home, Generosity and Self-Interest Among the Philanthropic Elite. Following that conversation, Joel Fleischman of Duke University provides a review of Odendahl's book, Philanthropy in America, Some Answers and Insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.